welcome to this, which is the third part and the last part, really, of my talk on the BBC. And I left you last week just after the Second World War. It's a very rapid story. And in the after the Second World War, remember, it's still radio. In fact, from the beginning, the story of 100 years of the BBC is mostly radio. Because although the television was first tested in 1936, in 1936, a television cost more than a car. So not many people had a television. Really, it's in the 1960s that television becomes really a thing for most people. When I was young in the 1960s, we had a television in winter, but not in summer. Because it's cheaper, and in summer we were supposed to play outside. It was very boring not having a television, but there you go, what can you do? No Google or anything. So, the radio service divided into three channels: the light programme, mostly popular music, also popular chat requests, disc jockeys and so on. The home service, somewhere in the middle, with some theatre and some classical music. And some news and comedy and so on. And the third programme, really rather intellectual, but nevertheless, very quickly, the BBC was under pressure from these companies who were running from abroad, Radio Normandy and Radio Luxembourg. This is from the 1930s, Radio Normandy, Radio Luxembourg were competing. But the situation had changed because it was necessary to respect popular culture more after the Second World War. Elitism, there's still plenty of elitism in the world today, but 100 years ago it was much bigger. You know, it was very common to hear people say, oh, working class people should not go to school. They're naturally stupid. It's not necessary. This was a very common opinion among the elite. Today, people in the elite, they don't say that. They sometimes think it, but they don't say it. Okay, so if we look at the period of French, the Trente Glorieuses, the boom period, 45 to 75, 1945 to 1975. Well, some of the things which were going on before continued. In general, the BBC followed the line of the government. It wasn't particularly radical. And in particular, for example, in 1972, when you had the events in Northern Ireland of Bloody Sunday, when the British soldiers shot dead 13 peaceful protesters, and the newspaper said the soldiers were obliged to shoot in self-defense. And the BBC said the soldiers were obliged to shoot in self-defense. Whereas today, the British government has officially apologized, and the British government's official position today is that the soldiers were wrong, that the people who were killed were not armed, and that they were shot in the back. Yeah, so it's not my opinion. Today, that is the government's opinion. It was a Conservative government which apologised, but 40 years later, which is always long. Whereas in 1972, the BBC, no problem, the soldiers were right, wonderful soldiers, and they were obliged to shoot these people. Here we have an article that one of my colleagues wrote, La BBC, l'information sur le conflit en Irlande du Nord. Spoiler. The BBC doesn't look good when you read this article, okay? This was one of the roles of the BBC. Was it supporting the status quo? Yes, but that's not all the BBC, but that is one of the things that the BBC did. At the same time, it was possible to see quite radical programmes on the BBC, and the most famous example is this series, The Wednesday Play, from 1964 to 1970, very well-known example. And this was the place where, have you heard of the filmmaker Ken Loach? Yeah? Now Ken Loach, he's not a conservative, is he? No, he's a radical filmmaker, and he learned to make films on the Wednesday Play on the BBC. The BBC trained Ken Loach, and also Mike Lee, and a few other really quite left-wing, radical. So the BBC could defend the status quo, but also they could sometimes leave space for quite radical voices. And in particular, these were very impressive. The most well-known was Kathy Come Home. This was one of Ken Loach's first productions, Kathy Come Home. It was about homelessness. It was about homelessness. And it was incredibly influential. Remember, this was 1966, I think. And millions of people have a television. Nobody has cable. Nobody has Netflix. And so half the population watched this play on a Wednesday night. It was a massive. I can't remember the numbers, but it's like 10 million people watched it, and it had a huge influence. And in fact, after this play by the one by Ken Loach, Kathy Come Home, a new organisation was established to fight against homelessness. It was a little bit of a big event. You had an event in France. Hiver 54, winter 1974, when l'abbé Pierre began his campaign. It was that kind of event in England at the time. Now, so it was possible inside the BBC to produce radical content. They had to be very clever. What they used to do was they used to say, oh, we've got a very radical play here. When is the manager on holiday? Oh, let's have the meeting when the manager is on holiday. They really did that. Inside the BBC, they had to be very clever to avoid some of the leaders of the BBC who didn't want radical plays, so they played around with it there. There was another one, a play called Up the Junction, which was about abortion. Abortion was legal in Britain after 1967. But in general, the BBC was not generally radical, but it could leave space for radicality. On the other hand, the BBC did open up new areas for people, and one of the things which is unfortunate about people talking about the BBC is that people very often talk about the news programmes or the current affairs programmes, which are very interesting, but most of the BBC is entertainment, sports, comedy. It's very, very varied, and one of the interesting points about this is that sports in Britain has been transformed by the BBC, because for a long time, ordinary people, they played football, cricket, rugby. That's it. And the BBC worked very hard to show new sports. They showed gymnastics on the BBC for the first time in 1954. In 1955, for the first time, they showed women playing cricket. Skateboarding. They showed skateboarding in 1977. In any case, it seems that seeing many different sports on television encouraged people to have a much wider choice in their lives. Some sports which were unknown gradually became popular, and today there are many, many different sports clubs. And as you know, the number of sports at the Olympics, every time there are more and more different sports. Now, some people think that this is very good, that the BBC as a public service should not just give people what they already know, but open up new spaces in their lives. And this is true in sports, for the BBC, but also cooking. Cooking programs really showed many, many people, oh yeah, I can learn Indian cooking, I can learn Russian cooking or whatever. But it really opened up. And this perhaps is one of the ways that public service means something. Here we have in 1971, sorry, in 1976, the BBC broadcast for the first time the Women's Football Cup Final. Now, in 1976, today we all love women's football. In 1976, it was radical to show women's football on the television. Certainly on some issues like on women's football, the commercial television was not so interested, because not as many people watched it, and so there was not as much money from advertising. And the BBC was, it's not the most radical thing in the world, but nevertheless, the BBC really pushed forward women's football. And women's football is tremendously important in Britain. Tremendously important, because you know that football in Britain is like a national religion. It's huge. And when you say women shouldn't do football, that really means that women are really not important at all. And so women's football, the message of women's football is not about football. It's women's places everywhere. And that's the most important message. Yeah? And so really women's football has been, especially in Britain, because football is so amazingly important in Britain, women's football has really changed the way that people look. If we look at music, then also the BBC has worked hard at making available a much wider variety of music, including popular music. One of the difficulties is that if you have a commercial radio station, they want to show music which is already popular. Because the advertisers demand, how many million people watch the show? The advertisers are not interested in, is the show innovative, etc. How many people watch the show? And the BBC, because it is not dependent on immediate statistics, they can be more adventurous. And so the BBC Two in particular has made a huge effort, even today in its podcasts, to have an enormous variety. So they have specialised programmes for dance music, folk music, brass band music, organ music, blues, jazz, country, etc. Now, each of these programmes is for a minority, but all the minorities together, that makes a lot of people. Even Radio 1, in 1967, they reorganised the radio. I showed you the three-part organization from the 1940 and from 1945. In 1967, they reorganized the radio again. They were under pressure. There were commercial stations, very well-known commercial stations like Radio Caroline, who solved in the 1960s. The BBC had a monopoly on radio. It was illegal for anybody else in Britain to produce radio. However, unfortunately for the BBC, Britain is an island, so it was not so difficult to have a ship with a radio station to go round Britain and broadcast to Britain. And this was a big thing in the 1950s. We called these the pirate radio stations. They weren't really pirates. They were just on a ship. And of course, the British government could do nothing. Nothing at all, because they were not in Britain. Yeah? And so Radio Caroline were tremendously popular, lots of popular music, rock music, when the BBC was saying, well, yes, I suppose we could have a little rock music once a week. Yeah? Yeah? And the Radio Caroline was a 24-hour music. Yeah? And so the BBC was under pressure, and they decided to reorganise everything in 1967, and they used the structure which they still use today. Radio 1, today's music, nothing more than 6 months old. Radio 2, popular music over the last 50 years. Some rock and roll, some dance, yeah. Radio 3, classical music and jazz. And Radio 4, talk, intelligent talk, documentaries, theatre, debates, politics, science, history, Radio 4. And this division still exists today. There are a few new ones, but 1, 2, 3, 4 still exists today. And so the BBC was being obliged to become more populist, if you like, to include more popular culture. But they tried very hard to continue being public service. And one example, because if you imagine today's pop music, you think, oh, well, today's pop music, generally commercial radio is interested because millions of people listen to it. However, there is an interesting a counterexample, and that is that the BBC was able to be more adventurous. And one of the great disc jockeys of the BBC was John Peel, who was a disc jockey. He began working in 67 and he died in 2004. And he produced four times a week a programme where he would play only unknown music. only new popular music, which was not famous and which nobody bought because it had just arrived. Yeah, so avant-garde, if you like, popular music. So he was one of the first people to put punk rock on the radio. He was one of the first people to put techno on the radio. He was looking ahead. In his opinion, in any case, in John Peel's opinion, this was only possible on a public service radio. Because when you say the commercial radio, you say to the commercial radio, I want to play music that nobody listens to yet. And the commercial radio, it's more difficult. I don't want to exaggerate because sometimes commercial radio does good work. But there is a space for public service, not just in the style of Arte, which is very good, but, you know, a little heavy, yeah? But also even in the popular music. Okay, so I was trying to show you in the period of the post-war boom, 45 to 75, that the BBC continued defending the status quo, but there were also radical voices sometimes. One of the problems with the radical voices is everybody always gives the same example. The Wednesday play, 1964 to 1967. And if everybody always gives the same example of radical content, it's because there wasn't very many examples. Yeah, it is a bit exceptional. And finally, a lot of popular education, cooking, new music that people don't hear of, different kinds of sport, and so on and so forth. Now let's have a look at a third period, which is the neoliberal era. Now the neoliberal era, vous l'avez peut-être remarqué, is still continuing today. I don't know if anybody noticed that, you probably did. So what is the neoliberal era? Well, in Britain, it came about mostly with the new government of Margaret Thatcher, but continued for many years after Margaret Thatcher. And it was the idea that public service, oh, that's not a very good thing, really. No. Private is better. Yeah, private is better. Thatcherism, which is the same thing as neoliberalism, said, we want weaker trade unions. We want privatized industry, not nationalized industry. Yeah. We want individual initiative. We want individuals to choose and to think about their own pension, not a collective solution for pensions, but an individual solution. We want, I'm pretending to be a Thatcherite, yeah, I'm not, in case you didn't know. We want, for example, take universities. The Thatcherite idea is very simple. People go to university because they want a better job, so they should pay for the cost of the university. That's the neoliberal way of... the other way of looking at it, the welfare state way of looking at it, is that our society needs lawyers and doctors and artists and historians, so it's a collective problem and it's good for the government to pay for universities. The neoliberals said, no, it's an individual problem, yeah? And so, as you know, in Britain today, to go to this university class, you would pay 11,000 euros a year. Je sais que ça vaut largement ça, but even so, it's still a lot of money, isn't it? It's still a lot of money. I will be having a little collection at the end of the class. Okay, right. Okay, so this is the new era, and this changed many things. The Thatcher government privatized many public services. They privatized gas, they privatized electricity, they privatized some prisons. Yeah? So the government paid a private company to organize a prison. Yeah? So in every area, the center of Thatcherism is the best way to organize human activity is the private company. So the more private companies, the better. That's what Thatcherism is. And this also occurred, this also changed things in the BBC. Here you have two pieces of documentation. On the left, you have something about the National Health Service. And it says how there was an attempt to involve the private sector in the National Health Service. Now, in Britain, one of the good things about the National Health Service is that you don't pay. You go to a doctor, you don't pay. It's not reimbursed, you just don't pay. Which obviously is good, But and Thatcher didn't dare change that. But what she did do is she said, right, if you take a hospital, well, let's privatise the parking, let's privatise the radiography department, let's privatise the canteen, etc. Yeah, so try to get the private sector in. And in the same way, in the BBC, they introduced this new system, producer choice, and this obliged the BBC to involve the private sector. So, for example, at one point, the Thatcher government said, the BBC today makes 70% of its own programmes. In future, you can only make 30% of your own programmes, and you must buy the other programmes from private companies. Yeah, so this was an idea of partial privatisation. And so the BBC, you see, the BBC always has to react very carefully. Every 10 years, the BBC says to the government, please, will you renew our charter? And so far, the government's always said yes. But the BBC doesn't want the government to be too unhappy. And so every 10 years, the BBC explains to the government why they should renew the charter and give them more money. Now, before 1980, they always said, oh, well, look, we're the BBC. We can do this and this and this and this and this. And all these things the private sector will not do. So we are the BBC. That's before 1980. After 1980, the BBC began to say, oh, we could do this to help the private sector. We could do this to help the private sector. That the whole ideology was different. And so that could make things more difficult. Now, Margaret Thatcher wanted to privatise the BBC. It's a great idea. And she never did, because it was politically impossible. It was too popular. It was too popular. Or rather, the way that she looked at it is, she said, well, if we privatise the BBC, we will save this much money. On the other hand, it will be very unpopular. What do we think? And in fact, if you look at the government budget, the BBC is not very expensive. It's the, you know, compared with the army and the schools and the universities and the hospitals and the roads and the rail, you know, it's not so big. So they never did. Also, there is a section. You see, Margaret Thatcher was the leader of the Conservative Party, but not everybody in the Conservative Party had the same idea. Inside the Conservative Party, there were a group of people who loved the BBC. You say, you know, the BBC educates people in a very fine way. All over the world, it is respected. And so there were conservatives who defended the BBC, as well as left-wing people. And so she got together a committee, the Peacock Commission. She got a committee and said, oh, you're an expert committee. Write me a report on the BBC. Tell me to privatise it, please. But they didn't. They didn't. They wrote it out, and they, oh yeah, it's not such a good idea to privatise. But what they did say, the Peacock Commission said, we could privatise Radio 1 and Radio 2, the popular music. But in the end, they didn't privatise Radio 1 and Radio 2, because it was going to be a big political scandal for a little advantage. And so the BBC survived and has still survived, even though today, again, it has a lot of problems because the government is reducing the budget. And also today, the government, some of the government, the Conservative government, those people who don't like the BBC, they have some more arguments today. The Conservatives who don't want to continue the BBC, they say, oh, well, today, everybody's watching Amazon and Netflix. The BBC is not so important. So that's an argument they use. Although, in fact, I think 65% of the British population use the BBC at least once a week. So it's still a real thing there. So now that's one important thing about the period 1980 till today: neoliberalism, privatisation, etc. We know this. Yeah, I've heard that in some countries they're trying to extend the age of when you can retire. I don't know. I know nothing about this. Okay. On the other hand, the period since 1980 is not only about neoliberalism. It's also been about some progress on questions of sexism, racism, homophobia. The progress on homophobia in the last 40 years, there's a lot left to do, but it's incredible. It's an incredible change. Unbelievable, literally. If somebody in 1980 went to sleep and woke up today and you explained to them that a conservative government in Britain introduced the law on gay marriage, they wouldn't believe you. It's impossible. It appears impossible. But there has been a lot of progress on homophobia. And so in this question of the progress against sexism, racism, homophobia, I want to say, has the BBC been leading these changes? Has the BBC been following these changes? Or has the BBC been resisting these changes? And of course, the answer is a bit of all of those, of course, you understand that. Because history is a complex process, the period since 1980 is not just the neoliberal era. The great social struggles of women, gay men and black Britons in the 1970s and 1980s produced results slowly. In 1979, 3% of members of parliament were women. In 1987, 6%. It's slow. 12 years. 1997, 18%. 2017, 29%. Yeah, so it was very slow, but it's suddenly going up. The same thing for questions of homosexuality. Homosexuality for men was reluctantly legalized in 1967. And in 2015, a conservative government passed a law allowing access to marriage for gays and lesbians. No, I don't want to look at that. Now, the BBC has been involved in this ongoing drive for social justice, not in an organised, coherent and deliberate way, but in a disorganised but often powerful way, as creative teams have found ways to encourage change. And here is a good example. This is 1986. And this is the first gay character in the very popular soap opera EastEnders. Now, soap operas in Britain, apart from football, are the other national religion. British people, when they go on holiday in Spain, they phone home and say, "What happened on EastEnders yesterday?" You know, because they don't want to miss it. There is an incredible attachment, and people feel like the characters on EastEnders are their friends, or Coronation Street. In fact, there are magazines about the soap operas. People write letters. You know, they write letters to the characters. Dear Mary, do not do this. I know you're thinking of marrying him. Don't marry him. No, they really feel like they know them. It sounds a bit crazy, but they're British. What can you do? But in any case, let's say that the people identify very strongly with the characters. Well, in 1986, they introduced the first gay character in EastEnders. And when he arrived to live in the street, the neighbours did not know he was gay, and the audience did not know he was gay. And for 4 months, he was just, I can't remember his name, he was just Billy. And we saw lots about his life, and we didn't know he was gay. And people, of course, and he was just, and then one day they found, everybody met his boyfriend. And on the street, some of the old people were very traditional and shocked, and others were not. So I think that this introduction of a gay character in EastEnders was probably did more against homophobia than 100 very good documentaries at 11 o'clock at night on BBC Two. Because it's part of the popular culture. Even, I suspect, you see, the soap opera feels to people like it's our people talking to us. And the problem with teachers or government ministers is they're not our people talking to us very often. C'est un des problèmes qu'on a dans les écoles quand on a le prof qui va donner un cours sur l'homophobie. les élèves, ils le prennent plus comme le prof que comme de l'information, quoi. Enfin, c'est mon avis. Another example I could give you is the first trans character in a soap opera in EastEnders also. 2015, we had the first trans character in EastEnders. Who I actually met a long time ago, before she was famous. I mean, I just met in a thing. Okay. In some other ways. Oh yeah. When they had this gay character on EastEnders, there was a lot of scandal. In the Parliament. Some members of Parliament said that they wanted the series to be cancelled because there were gay people in the series. 1989, yeah, that was 1989. The 20th century. Don't go there. It was horrible. Okay. So finally, let's just say a few things about today. The public service today. Before I look a little bit at science programs, if I have time. So today, these different priorities: serving the status quo, serving the government, serving the consumers, serving the citizens, serving the people. They can all exist, and it's up to everybody to decide, you know, whether they think on balance the BBC is very positive or not. The BBC is very much criticised from the left and from the right. Left-wing people criticise the BBC because they say, look at the news. It's always encouraging neoliberalism. On every news programme you have today, the stock market is doing this. There are if you have shares in Shell, they're worth 5% more. Most people don't have shares, but it's on every day on the news. The left wing accuse the BBC of having programmes like The Apprentice, where you know the hero is the best entrepreneur, and all this kind of conservative ideologies. At the same time, the right wing, the conservatives, are not happy with the BBC either. Now, the problem with the BBC is that they listen too much to the voices of women, homosexuals, black people, etc. So the BBC gets criticised from the left and from the right. So the BBC traditionally says, oh, look, we are criticised from the left and we are criticised from the right. That shows that we are right. It doesn't necessarily show that, but that really is the argument they used. Today, the BBC has a number of problems. First of all, because the Conservative government has decided on a freeze in the licence fee. The licence fee, la redevance, will not rise over the next 5 years. And as you know, with today's inflation, that means the BBC has less and less money. The BBC had, last year, the BBC had 22,000 employees. And they just decided that this year they're only going to have 21,000. So they're cutting employees. Okay, so the other thing I wanted to mention is the women's football. So I just have 5 minutes to talk about one specific example, and this is science programs. Now, Naomi just talked to us about a science program, I think. Yes, that's right. And I think science is a good example of how the BBC organised popular education in a way, organised and organises popular education in a way that nobody else can. Now, this goes back a long way. Here is a programme from 1923. Radio programmes from the BBC from 1923, and you can see a talk on the chemistry of life by Dr. So-and-so. Yeah, this is for the general public. And notice what you get, also 1923, what you get here, very modern idea, the chemistry of a washing day. Qu'est-ce qui se passe dans la chimie? Le jour du linge. Le jour pour laver le linge. So this is an attempt to take science and apply to it something that people know every day. Now, I should explain a little bit. In 1923, when you do not have a washing machine, but more important, you do not have modern detergents, it's much washing is 10 times harder. Yeah. Of course, you know about that the washing machine made things better, made things easier, but the detergents also tremendously more effective. So they talk about science, but in a way that it links it to everyday life. Here's another one, another science program from 1923. A short talk on the history of mathematics. Again, just like the other ones we saw, this is not for the people listening are not mathematicians. It's the general public. Now, perhaps not all the general public, but the general curious public. So right back in 1923, they had this sort of thing. Now, much more recently, there's been a series of science programs which have been tremendously successful and which get millions of viewers every time. Horizon continued for 40 years, 60 years, 1964 to 2022. And they spoke about what was happening this month in science. And they, from the very beginning, the Horizon team was determined that the science should not be oversimplified. Here you have some examples of recent episodes of Horizon, from mathematics at the bottom, Fermat's last theorem. En français, on dit le grand théorème de Fermat, et pas le dernier, mais en anglais, on dit le dernier. C'est le dernier et le grand. There you have the space station, food, multiple universes. So very, very varied science program. Perhaps even more impressive is the Sky at Night. This is a program about astronomy, and it was on. It was from 1957 to 2022, and it was presented by the same man from 57 to 2013. Yeah. That's what he did. That was his career. He presented this was Patrick Moore, who was a very, very impressive gentleman. And they used to talk about general topics of astronomy, like, you know, black holes or moons. And at the same time, every month, they would also say, what is happening in the sky tonight? If you go outside, what can you see which is special tonight? So again, very strong emphasis on popular education. Again, very, very long-lived programs. Tomorrow's World, 1965 to 2003. What do you think he's doing here? This is, I think it's 1978, and he's showing you a mobile phone. Now, this appeared to be an impossible idea. This is the mobile phone he's carrying, because nobody had ever seen a mobile phone, you see. They showed the first digital watch in 1972, the first mobile phone in 1979. But of course, they also presented many inventions that never succeeded. Today, you have radio programs like The Life Scientific, where they take one scientist and they ask him or her how they became interested in the subject that they work on. Here are some of the recent episodes of The Life Scientific. It's a podcast, it's on the BBC website. And so, you know, you get all these different possibilities. Somebody about medicine, somebody about coral reefs, le corail, somebody about what you can learn, qu'est-ce qu'on peut apprendre en étudiant le contenu des égouts. As you remember that in COVID, that was very important, actually. They could know where COVID was stronger by testing the sewage waters, things like that. Okay. Otherwise, you saw the How Earth Made Us, and there have been a series, several series on this, sometimes with the same gentleman. This series, The Measure of All Things, which is basically the history of mathematics. Yeah, the history of mathematics. Again, not for that one's the history of mathematics. Not for mathematicians. For people who want to know about it anywhere. And sometimes you get also more light-hearted approaches. This one is from The Secrets of Size, and you can see that they try to make it amusing as well. So here he's talking about an atom, and the atom appears in front of him. That sort of thing, yeah? Though he is again, he's talking about a wavelength, so the wavelength appears in front of him. And here he is blowing up gloves just to explain things. So the science programs avoid serious talking heads. They do not say, here is a university professor who is going to explain to you. They try to make it, they try not to simplify the science, but to make it a little bit more dynamic. So that's one example. These are some of the history of science pieces. Men of Rock is about the history of geology. Who were the people, in fact men, it was the 19th century, who discovered amazing stuff about 19th century. Now, commercial television cannot produce this stuff because you don't get immediate advertising results. In any case, commercial television never produces this stuff. I tested, whether you look at commercial television like ITV or Netflix, they do zero in popularizing science. I studied this. And the BBC also does this in history, 19th century history, history of art, contemporary history, and so on. So really, I guess I am kind of defending the BBC, but let's say that one of its strongest points is popular education. That although it's certainly true that it tends to defend the status quo, even when the status quo is not so good, nevertheless, in popular education, it is one of the best in the world, and I hope that they don't manage to privatize it. Thank you very much for listening so carefully. That's